I'm Afshin Ratansi, and you're watching Going Underground, broadcast around the world, but banned in Europe, though always available on RT.com and Odyssey and live on Rumble.com. Coming up on the show, as Russia becomes the most sanctioned country in the world, overtaking Iran, we ask Tehran University's Professor Mohammad Mirandi about the effects of economic warfare and how Ukraine may permanently shake up world power politics as Britain, the EU and USA pour arms into Ukraine to fight Russia. And as the International Criminal Court investigates alleged war crimes by Russia in Ukraine, we investigate arguable parallels with UK-US EU-armed Israeli military actions in the Middle East in another week of bombing of Damascus with Princeton's legendary UN Special Rapporteur in Palestine, Professor Richard Falk. All this and more coming up in today's Going Underground, but first, all week, as Russia moved into Ukraine, the global UN nuclear IAEA organization has been talking in Vienna amidst media reports of alleged US biowarfare labs in Ukraine, denied by the Pentagon, of alleged Russian interference at Chernobyl, killing at a maternity hospital, denied by Russia, and, as usual in NATO nation media, the dangers of a JCPOA deal with Iran. Let's go straight to Vienna and speak to Professor Mohammad Mirandi of Tehran University. Thank you so much, Professor Mirandi, for coming back on the show before we even get to Ukraine. Presumably, you're glad that the apparently sanctions have been lifted on President Raisi, on the president, and recognition of Iran ally Venezuela's President Maduro. Is the IAEA changing attitudes towards Iran, and do you expect now the deal to go through?
The expectation in Iran is that all these brutal sanctions are removed. They were never justified. There was never any evidence that Iran was seeking a nuclear weapon. The intrusive sanctions that we've had in Tehran, in Iran, for years have proven that. But the United States and its allies have always used any excuse available to antagonize Iran and to hurt ordinary Iranians. The United States accuses Iran of terrorism, whereas the United States has surrounded Iran with military bases. It has killed senior Iranian officials with the Israelis. It's assassinated people. And it has been helping terrorist groups in Syria and Iraq and elsewhere. So the real problem is not Iran, which is in this neighborhood. It is the United States, which is oppressing Iranians, which is strangling Iranians, and which is threatening Iranians thousands of kilometers, a mile or miles away from its own border. So our hope is that the sanctions regime will end, whether it's in Iran or Venezuela or Cuba or Nicaragua or Yemen or Syria or Afghanistan. All of these are unjust and barbaric.
Yeah, obviously the United States completely denies helping terrorism, and Russia is now more sanctioned than Iran. We had John Bolton on the show. People around the world can watch our interview on YouTube, except in Europe, where it's on Odyssey. He's the former U.S. ambassador to the UN, of course, former national security advisor. He said, yeah, sanctions obviously do work because that's what brought Iran back to the table to negotiate over its nuclear program. It's the sanctions on Iran that has brought Iran to the table.
Well, that doesn't justify anything to brutalize a population, but that is not correct either. The Iranians only accepted negotiations with the United States once they accepted Iran's right to enrich uranium. That was the key. So it was the United States that backed down. Although Obama was the first person to initiate these maximum pressure sanctions targeting women and children and killing innocent people, it was only when he saw that it was a dead end that he had to accept Iran's rights. But I think that that era is coming to an end. The United States, when it has to come to Iran and seek some sort of solution with the country, when it has to go to Venezuela, when they confiscated or stolen Venezuelan assets and they chose their own president for the country, but now they have to go and seek the Venezuelan leadership for negotiations and for oil, that shows that the world is changing and the United States no longer is in the position that it had held before. And Iran recognizes that, and therefore Iran will be more assertive in defending its sovereignty than before, even though Iran has always been very assertive in that regard.
The Bank of England obviously denies stealing that Venezuelan gold, and Britain, as things stand, does not recognize Nicolas Maduro as the elected president of Venezuela. But what we're hearing in NATO nation media suggests a separation between Iran and Russia as events unfolded in Ukraine, because they say Lavrov is leveraging Washington and all the arguable vassal states, of course, in Europe, and unnamed officials being quoted in some mainstream media, Heritage Foundation, so-called mainstream media. It's not constructive, any change of tack by Russia at the Vienna talks.
Well, I'm sure some people in Iran, liberals, will take what I say out of context, so I'll try to be very careful. First of all, the regimes that imposed the sanctions on Iran for the last decade were Western, whether under Obama or Trump or Biden. It was the United States that strangled Iran. And those powers, those global powers that resisted the sanctions more than anyone else were China and Russia. There's no doubt about that. And back then, when the sanctions were first imposed, China and Russia were much weaker than they were today. Their ability to resist was much smaller, and gradually they grew more powerful and they became more resistant. So we have to keep that in mind. In addition to that, what the Russians say is factually correct. The sanctions imposed on Russia will impede Iran's trade relations because Western countries, we know, are not going to come to Iran to invest or to normalize trade. And the United States, of course, will never do that. So the only real options, aside from the global south and aside from neighboring countries and regional countries, are Russia and China, India as well, and so on. And so if Russia is prevented from normalizing trade with Iran, then that impedes the implementation of the JCPOA. However, the Iranians want the deal to be to come to a conclusion and for all sides to accept it. So we are waiting to see what will happen. Ultimately, for Iran, what is important is that the injustice that has been imposed upon the Iranian people come to an end.
Have you been surprised at the global reaction to events in Ukraine? Obviously, Europe did what Washington wanted it to do, but as you mentioned, India not voting for the US condemnation or even deploring Russia's moves into Ukraine, Brazil's reaction, Pakistan's reaction. You been surprised at, or has this been a long time coming, the end of hegemonic Washington power?
Well, let me first mention one point, and that is that in 2003, when the Americans wanted to invade Iraq, we hated Saddam Hussein more than anyone else. He used chemical weapons against us, of course, with European and American support. They gave him that capability, the military intelligence and the political cover to get away with very huge chemical attacks, which I survived two of those attacks, and many people didn't. But we were opposed to the war. I took part in the anti-war protests in London, and the Iranian government opposed the war because it was not legitimate. And even if the UN Security Council had approved it, it would not have been legitimate to Iran. And therefore, Iran does not consider this war to be legitimate. When it opposes war against Saddam, it obviously will support, will oppose a war against Ukraine as well. But I think what we are seeing now is the rapid decline of NATO and the United States and its power, because the United States has already been on the decline. We saw that over the last few years, the divisions in the United States, the economic crisis, the social and political crisis that we saw there. We see the decline in Europe and the rise of alternative powers that are standing up against the old order.
Over here, we hear that NATO has never been more united, actually?
Well, they can be as united as they want, but the point is that they are becoming increasingly weakened. And their sanctions on Russia will backfire because Russia has the resources and the minerals and the oil and gas that they need. And the Russians will sanction them as well. And as the United States and the Europeans are trying to crush Russia in the Ukraine, and the Russians are trying to crush NATO in Ukraine, that weakens all of these powers. And the Global South simply watches. Of course, this war is going to create enormous problems for the world. I think it'll create starvation in parts of the world because of the rising price of grains and wheat. But in any case, I think that we are seeing a changing world. We're seeing the end of the current world order. We're moving towards, I think, a multipolar world of disorder, where you're going to have different poles, but I think there's going to be a lot of disorder coming. I think the times ahead are going to be very, very difficult for everyone, but we are going to see the decline of the United States more rapid than before.
Just on those wheat prices, can we expect so-called Washington proxy governments in the Global South to be destabilized by their populations who can't afford bread?
Remember the Arab Spring, or what some call the awakening. A lot of it had to do with the price of bread and the survival of ordinary people. With things moving forward as they are across the Global South, I think you're going to see major problems. And I think you may see many governments fall, and you may see people die of starvation in some areas. But I also think that you're going to see a huge decline in the fortunes of the already destroyed middle class across Europe and the United States. And I don't think that is going to end well for these countries, because under those circumstances, societies change for the worse.
Professor Morandi, I'll stop you there. More from the renowned scholar from the University of Tehran after this break. Plus, are there parallels between Israel, Palestine and Russia-Ukraine as Israel joins the 141 countries at the UN who condemned Russia's actions in Ukraine? We investigate all this and more coming up in part two of Going Underground. Welcome back. I'm still with the renowned Professor Mohammad Morandi of Tehran University, who joins me from Vienna. Iranian media has been targeted in NATO countries for many years, CGTN, the Chinese news media, obviously now Russian media. What do you think of Russian sources saying there may be a justification in international law if biowarfare labs are indeed discovered in Ukraine that mean that WMD, that old phrase from Iraq, as we know, there was no WMD in Iraq, the WMD was on Russia's borders, therefore Russia had to act.
Well, I hope you are able to show at some point the clip of the U.S. Deputy Secretary of State when she was discussing this. It was obvious she was extremely nervous. The body language was extraordinary. Obviously, something very sinister was happening. It's no ordinary biolab. If it was something in the open, then they should not be concerned at all that the Russians would gain access to it. It's a fact that these are the same Western countries that gave Saddam Hussein chemical weapons. If it was an ideal world, the Western media, instead of cheerleading the war, I would imagine from their narratives that this is what BBC would be doing, that North Korea would be something like the BBC today and CNN today. When you watch them, it's just disgusting. They're just cheerleaders for war. But when the war on Iraq was taking place, they were cheerleading the occupation. Shock and awe wasn't a bad thing back then. When chemical weapons were being given to Saddam to use against Iranians and the city of Halabja, where in one attack, 5,500 people were massacred, they were silent about it.
The Pentagon denies, obviously, biowarfare, and those kind of comparisons with the atrocities committed alleged atrocities committed by NATO powers is seen as whataboutery. Just quickly, I need to go back, go to Turkey, where, of course, there was this extraordinary meeting between foreign ministers. It didn't seem to be peace negotiations. What do you think about Turkey's position, given it's a NATO member and Russia can switch off its S-400 system at a stroke?
Well, the Turkish president is a person who is constantly shifting his position. One day he's against Israel, the next day he's hosting the Israeli president. One day he's friends with the Syrian president and they go out with their families together. The next day he's assisting ISIS and Al-Qaeda to destroy the country and to overthrow the Syrian government. But now, basically, what the Turkish government has done is that they've destroyed their credibility across the globe. No one trusts President Erdogan, whether it's Ukraine or Russia or NATO or even the Israeli regime or regional countries.
Just very briefly, I mean, obviously we invite the Turkish ambassador on. I just got to briefly ask you about Syria, because there are reports of Islamists previously supported and linked to NATO governments. What is the latest you're hearing about the bombing of Damascus, one of the oldest inhabited cities of the world, just this week by UK, US, EU nation armed Israeli warplanes?
Well, when the Israeli regime bombs Damascus, they are violating international law, but in the Western media, it's fine. When they're starving Yemen, a war which is far worse than Ukraine, and thousands of British advisors are helping keep the Saudi Air Force afloat, we don't hear that in the media. These cheerleaders on the BBC and CNN and elsewhere are silent about that. It's utterly racist. But when it comes to Syria, I think one of the interesting things is that, first of all, these are not Islamists, just as the neo-Nazis and the Nazis in Europe are not Christian. These are extremist groups that are used as tools by Western powers, by the Israelis, by Erdogan, by NATO, and by oil-rich despots in the region that have been allies of the United States, just as the neo-Nazis are being used and just as the Contra-rebels were being used against the Nicaraguans. The Americans and the Europeans use these extremists because it's like shock and awe. It's like in Iraq. The Americans were proud of shock and awe. What was shock and awe? It was to create fear among ordinary Iranians. It was to make Iraqis in awe of American might, which is utterly barbaric. That's why they use extremists in Syria. That's why they use extremists in Europe. That's why they use extremists in the global south.
Obviously, Washington and Brussels denies that. Professor Mohamed Mirandi, thank you.
Thank you.
Now, while Russia has continued bombing Ukraine this week and while the International Criminal Court investigates alleged war crimes, UK-US-EU-armed Israel, also investigated for alleged war crimes, has continued its bombing of Damascus, according to Syrian state media. Joining me now from California is Professor Emeritus of International Law at Princeton University and the former UN Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories, Richard Falk. Professor Falk, welcome to Going Underground. You're a legend as far as UN Special Rapporteurs go. We've had many UN Special Rapporteurs on, but you made UN Special Rapporteurship what it is, arguably. Israelis, then, are volunteering to join up with the alleged, though denied by them, neo-Nazi-affiliated Ukrainian army. I better start by asking you, as a Special Rapporteur on Palestine, what the situation in Russia-Ukraine is as regards parallels with Israel-Palestine?
I think the parallels are rather striking in the sense that the empathy and the outpouring of response to the humanitarian crisis caused by the Russian invasion of Ukraine has produced something absolutely different than the Palestinian victimization over decades. And it is it can be explained by many in many ways. This is partly a renewal of the ideological fervor of the Cold War. It is partly an expression of selective empathy for Christian white victims. The Syrian refugees during the Syrian civil strife were welcomed with barbed wire in Europe while the Ukrainian refugees are being welcomed with open arms and warm shows of hospitality.
Arguably not warm arms in Britain. There's a bit of controversy about that. But Antonio Guterres, Secretary General of the UN, very quick to declare Russia violated the UN Charter. I mean, what is he like? I mean, did he support your work with Virginia Tilley in your 2017 report when you accused Israel of apartheid? I know Amnesty International now accuses Israel of apartheid too, which Israel denies. What is Antonio Guterres like? And what did he think of your report?
Well, I think it was less Guterres than succumbing to the pressure exerted by the U.S. Nikki Haley in the Security Council singled out the report for condemnation. He was a new Secretary General at the time. She threatened the U.N. with funding consequences if he failed to denounce the report. In actuality, he only removed it from the website. He never actually repudiated the report, but it was a sign of the weakness of the UN that it can't respect the political independence of its own actions and is subject to the what I call the primacy of geopolitics.
Although, of course, Rima Khalaf had to withdraw the report and she left the organization at the UN. What does it feel like for you? I mean, it's 10 years since your UN General Assembly report de facto arguing for BDS because of Israeli violations of resolutions. Susan Rice, I mean, she's now a... she was then US ambassador to the UN. Now she's a Biden official. She called your report irresponsible and acceptable. But she now supports a boycott of Russia. And you might have heard that here in Wales, in Britain, Tchaikovsky is being banned. Sopranos are being sacked in New York and conductors in Milan.
It shows the pervasiveness of double standards, the control of the international political and moral discourse by the U.S., and it is a exaggerated response that has not been duplicated in other comparable situations like the Iraq invasion of 2003. So there's every reason to, on the one hand, regret the humanitarian crisis that has been caused by the Russian invasion, but at the same time to point out that this is an illustrative of a geopolitical response, not a even-handed legal and moral response.
It was, of course, Mordecai Vanunu, who was honey-trapped here in London, who revealed to us what he said was the Israeli nuclear weapons program. As one of the most famous former UN special rapporteurs, how close do you think we are to nuclear confrontation? Sergei Lavrov said it's always NATO that raises the threat. Obviously, the Ukrainian president has raised the need to perhaps rearm with nuclear weapons, and Russian nuclear weapons have been put on high alert.
I think there is a serious danger, both from the nuclear reactors that are in Ukraine and could be hit with either accidentally or deliberately, either by saboteurs or by the Russian military presence. And then there's the danger of escalation. Whenever there's a confrontation of this sort, as occurred in the Cuban Missile Crisis back in 1962, one has to worry about the mutually catastrophic consequences of escalating across the nuclear threshold. And I think it's one hopes that the leaders on both sides have the prudent awareness of these risks and will act accordingly.
While we both and all of us here at Going Underground sympathize with all the victims of the current conflict, do you think that we may be entering a new world order where all the so-called unworthy victims, as Chomsky and Edward Herbman talked about, will now be recognized? There won't be any more Iraqs, Afghanistans, Yemens, Libyas, Syrias?
I think that's too much to hope for, realistically. I feel that the primacy of geopolitics is such that the permanent members of the Security Council, who are given, in a sense, an exemption from complying with the UN Charter through the veto power, will continue to pursue their strategic interests as they see fit. And I think one of the things that's at stake at the present time is whether the aftermath of the Cold War gives rise to a second Cold War or ends the unipolarity that the U.S. has claimed since the end of the Cold War and proclaims its global security has no borders, is planetary in scope.
Professor Richard Falk, thank you. And that's it for the show. If you're watching on Saturday, we'll be broadcasting this show again on Monday. But on Wednesday, we'll be back with a brand new episode. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's available in your country. And let us know if you think NATO Nation Media is ignoring NATO hypocrisy over Ukraine. And if you are a Ukrainian official, please get in touch to give your side of the Ukraine story. So far, we've had difficulty in getting any response to our invitations. And remember, all Going Underground episodes are available to watch at rt.com.